Welcome to What's the Quarantine. We have Paul Pillay with us today, the Managing Director of Youth Lab ZA. And we're going to be talking about something quite interesting today, which is based around the legacy of apartheid in the education system. Paul, tell us a bit about the Youth Lab, and then we'll get into this messy-ass business.
Cool. Hi, everybody. So I'm Paul, and I run an organization called Youth Lab. What Youth Lab is, so I'll give you like the fancy website definition and then like the real life definition. Youth Lab is a youth policy think tank. And the work that we do is around two things. Number one is building youth capabilities. And number two is mainstreaming youth participation. What that means in real life is that the work that we do is basically to support young people in whatever fields that may be. So if you're a young entrepreneur, if you're a young student, if you're a young person interested in policy, if you're a young community activist, our work is to A, find ways to amplify your voice, but B, find ways to improve your capacity so that the work you do can be more impactful and more sustainable. Youth Lab's been around since 2012, so it's 8 years now. I've been there since 2014, so it's about 6 years. So we're based in Johannesburg, but we obviously do work all around the country and in a few other countries as well. It's really, the work is about helping young people take up their place as, you know, the majority of this population, as people who should be mainstreamed and prioritized in all of our government interventions, and just finding different ways and spaces to do that.
How easy is it for, you know, the quote unquote youth to actually effect change within the echelons of government, or through your organization?
Girl, I wish you asked me this question like 3 years ago. I would have given you such a happy response. The truth of the matter is that it's actually really difficult, right? So we're lucky that we come from a country that has such a massive protest culture, and we've seen what protests can do. We've seen what like collective action can do, and all of those things are still true. Obviously, the only difficulty right now is that, you know, we live in a state that has no problem shooting you for protesting, you know? And so that aspect of kind of brutality and state force and all of that is a big hindrance to being able to make social change. But when you think about it from an organizational point of view and you know, the kind of civic society work that we do, it's actually not that easy. So we live in a system that is like deeply political, right? But not just political, it's deeply partisan. And unfortunately, unless you're part of the right party, in most cases, obviously the ANC, there isn't a lot of space for you as a young person to make yourself heard, to be taken seriously. That's part of the reason why Youth Lab was created. The people that founded Youth Lab believed that young people are very active and have things to say, but in this country, you're often dismissed if you don't wear the right political cap. And we needed to find a way for young people to be able to be heard and be able to affect change and be taken seriously, but not necessarily in partisan ways. So it's incredibly difficult. We have, you know, the idea of like state corruption and nepotism and partisanship and all of those things are so entrenched in every single sphere of our society that you can have the best intentions, but there's no platforms. And particularly as a young person, we don't really have strong youth structures or youth development mechanisms that exist for you to be able to make yourself heard and make a change. And so unfortunately, it's got to be, you know, resorting to things like collective action and protesting, or, you know, mobilizing online and that kind of stuff. But just the idea that there's a space where you as a young person can go and make yourself heard and be taken seriously, unfortunately, those spaces don't really exist in this country.
That's really disappointing. I mean... I mean, there's always such a drive from government, you know, to push the voices of the youth, especially with, you know, the history of our country and how the youth really drove moving us out of, you know, the clutches of oppression, you know, in the 70s and in the 80s and things like that. And so it's really sad to hear how there's no sort of reverence for, you know, what the youth can actually bring. And it probably, this is why our cabinet looks like they are basically on their deathbeds.
Yeah, but it's like the cabinet, it could be a brochure for an old age home easily. Parliamentarians often say, you know, when you have young people in parliament, there's lots of them that say, oh, parliament's not a creche. They're very right. It's not a creche. It's an old age home. Like, there's no two ways about it. But it's, you know, the way our leadership is set up, right, is they do take youth seriously. Let's not lie. But it's the kind of young person that they take seriously that's problematic, right? So the idea of being palatable exists in so many spheres of a society, right? So women are only taken seriously if you're the right kind of woman. You know, you say things in the right way, whatever. Black people want to talk about something like Black Lives Matter, but you shouldn't do it whilst you're protesting, you know? You have to always be palatable to the system. And that's true for young people as well. So unless you're politically connected, unless you're not willing to publicly criticize, unless you're willing to, you know, kind of toe the line, you don't get access to these kinds of spaces. And so when government says they take youth seriously, they know that there's this very specific kind of young person they're talking about. We're the idiots who think they mean everybody, right? And that's just never been true. But all of the rhetoric around young people specifically, because, you know, in terms of numbers, we're the largest part of the population. We're the largest voting bloc. All of those things. We know all of those things. But what government has done is they've turned the idea of youth and the conversation around youth into just like rhetoric. So they'll say, youth are the future. I've been seeing this week, the president was talking about how young people need to take the risk and jump into entrepreneurship. And I was like, what a terrible piece of advice to give to young people. Like, why would you say that? So it's young people are used as tokens, right? It's a very tokenistic relationship that government has with us, where we can be called upon when it's time to rally, you know, for something. Young people must rise up and they must take action. Or we're called on to solve problems. Young people must give their inputs on how to solve unemployment in this country. You know, even though you have ministers that are paid millions of rands to do the same thing. Or we're used as the scapegoat when you want to blame things on people. Oh, our political participation is so low because youth are apathetic. And so youth is not really a thing that government takes seriously and sees as a segment of the population that has to actually be prioritized. It's actually just something that they use when it's convenient to suit whatever agenda they're trying to meet at that particular time. It's really upsetting.
I mean, I don't want this to become an ANC bashing session, but the truth of the matter is that they are at the helm of the ship at this point, and it is sinking. So I think with that, let's move into, you know, a couple of years ago when most of us were still babies and you probably weren't born yet. And
thanks, Taryn.
How old are you now? You're like 26, 27.
I mean, that's great. I'm 28.
Oh, are you? Okay, sorry.
I'll take 26. I'll take it. It's fine. I'll take it.
It's your lovely curls that's giving you this youthful glow, you know?
Yeah, it's just my face. You know, I just woke up and
like woke up like this. So, yeah, anyway, so let's just take it back like a few decades and look at what kind of education system we had back then. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So obviously we know during apartheid we had Bantu education, right? And this was the idea that Black people in particular could only, you know, you only need to learn the things that are going to be useful for the future that we've envisioned for you, basically. So the idea that all Black people are destined to be as workers, you know, laborers, majorly sort of unskilled, uneducated. And so the education system then reflected that. So you don't need to learn biology if you, there's no way you're going to be a doctor. And that idea that you only need to be given the kinds of resources that will contribute to the future they've imagined pervaded all parts of the education system. So the way schools were built, the way schools were planned, you know, things like zoning, curriculum, teaching resources, all of that was geared to maintain that sense of inequality. That since, you know, if you're a Black person, you're at the bottom of the racial hierarchy, so you get the bottom of the barrel resources. And that's the system that kind of kept through, you know, for decades and decades. If you think about, and if I think about my community, Indian people, you could be a teacher, you could be an accountant, I think you could be like a nurse, you could be maybe a lawyer. And those, you know, those were the options that you had, and everything that you learned in school was geared towards those things specifically. And so what that meant was that the education system was churning out people who could not function outside of what apartheid told them they were. And obviously then, if you think about the unemployment crisis we have today, those things are all like knock-on effects, right? Because now you have obviously a majority Black population, but generationally, people were ill-equipped with poor education that has meant that they're not really very employable right now. And all of those inequalities from back then, we still see in the education system right now. So a typical thing when we talk about education is we talk about infrastructure, right? And so the idea that there are schools that don't actually have buildings or schools that don't have sanitation or water or chairs or windows is part of the legacy of apartheid that said if you're Black and if you're poor, you don't need nice things. And the nice things were reserved for the people that could afford it. And so that's basically what the apartheid education system did, is it boxed people according, obviously, to race, but according to what the apartheid government decided you could be in life. And unfortunately, the democratic government has failed to undo that system of inequality and that structure. And we see it kind of existing then in schools today.
I mean, it's horrific to think about that these structures do exist. And I do want to delve into why this has sort of, you know, continued to occur within our society. I mean, where's the redress? We're 26 years post-apartheid. Like, something was supposed to happen. Nothing's really happened. And, you know, when I was listening to the panel that you guys had on the legacy of apartheid in education, one of your panelists had mentioned the story of Michael Kumape, who was a child who had essentially drowned in a pit toilet. And a pit toilet, for those who don't know, you know, we've got an international audience. But
Okay.
Maybe the international audience can understand how absolutely horrific it is living in this country sometimes. But basically, a pit toilet is just like a huge sort of latrine kind of thing, where there's just a bunch of, you know, your feces and everything else. There's no like plumbing involved. And so this child was at school, and they have a pit toilet on the school grounds, and fell into the pit toilet and drowned and choked on feces. And I think, you know, it's obviously horrifically appalling, but also this was only the the parents only got paid out last year, December. And this had happened 6 years ago already. So they had to like struggle to even get justice for this poor child.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when I read that story, like the first thing I was thinking about was, can you imagine your, because Michael was what? He was like six, I think. He was in primary school, right? So he was under 10. And I'm thinking, you at that age, you go to school and you fall into this pit of human feces and you drown in it. Like the level of trauma of just absolute failure of the world to protect you as a child, right? And like, I think about those moments in the story when like the mom had gone to the school and, you know, they hadn't even like retrieved his body and, you know, she was there for all of that and just like the levels and levels and levels. And then the state fighting it, saying that the family is trying to get money off of them. Like, it was wild. And what struck me most about all of that was when Equal Education had asked Minister Motsekga about pit toilets. And, you know, we know that that school obviously isn't the only school that has them. And they asked a simple question: how many schools in South Africa have pit toilets? And the Minister of Basic Education said, I don't know. And this is 20 years into democracy, right? It's horrifying. And it's such a failure. It's a failure of society. It's a failure of those ministers and those leaders at a very like human level, right? Because it's this idea that they get to go to private schools. Their kids get to go to private schools. They get to access private healthcare. Everything they do is privatized, right? They get to pay for the best of the best, or the state subsidizes them to get the best of the best. And the people that put them in that position have their children drowning in toilets. And it shows you, right, the gap, first of all, between the rich and the poor in this country. But it also shows you how little we value, like, education, right? So the idea that you don't think that kids need good schools. And you think that being able to go to a school in which you don't have toilets somehow means that you're going to be the person that's going to come and grow up and be like a doctor or a scientist and like find the cure for cancer. Like, it's not going to happen, right? And so you hear stories like that of Michael, and Michael wasn't the first child. He wasn't the last child. I think we had an incident this year already of another child drowning in a pit toilet. And it's just like, how long must we as citizens sit and live through this experience, right? Before like something changes. So the idea of school infrastructure is such a simple idea. It's not a difficult thing to put toilets in schools. Like, it's not hard. But we don't, the few problems we have is that, number one, I don't think when the ANC took over power that there was enough work done around creating democratic systems, right? So the way government was inherited, a lot of the way the apartheid government functions from like a process point of view is still the way it functions right now, right? And there wasn't a reimagining of what does governing and running a country look like from a democratic point of view. Like, what is the kind of country we want to build? How do we want to make it happen? What skills do we need to have? Who do we need to hire to be able to carry out that work? So I don't think there was enough of that. And then the second thing is we just don't have political will. So that's, you know, it's a term that people use a lot. And what it just basically means is that leaders, they just don't want to. They just don't want to make things better, because the way greed is set up, the way things like corruption is set up, is it's the idea of the individual that as long as I'm fine and my family's fine, to hell with everybody else. And that's something that is characteristic of most of the leaders we have, is it's this individualistic way of looking at the world and thinking that it's okay for someone's child to go and use a pit toilet whilst your child, you know, has like fully functioning sanitation at home. And that's where the bulk of our problems begin, is that we have enriched and upheld and brought in leadership that is so weak that they're not able to just not think about themselves for 2 minutes and just do their jobs. And that's why then you have cases like Michael.
I mean, if we think about the way that government looks like, you know, a couple of years back with, you know, the whole Zuma must fall and all of these things, you know, with Jacob Zuma coming in, you know, corruption was really laid openly and transparently for the first time in a long time. And we also, I think, had the right minds to come together to actually take on the government or, you know, hold them accountable in a way that would never have happened before, right? And of course, with the opposition coming in, they had a real opportunity, you know, not that, you know, I'm, you know, jonesing for a DA-led government, but
oh goodness,
but there was an opportunity.
What fresh hell would that be?
But I mean, there was an opportunity for opposition parties to really have a look at what's going on here and turn it around, you know. But
yeah,
they were so lazy and decided to make it a problem of, you know, well, it's not the ANC, it's just Zuma, and making it all like factional and stuff like that. And okay, Zuma came out.
And now Zuma's gone.
Yeah,
now
Zuma, he left, and the new dawn came in, and the wool was pulled over the eyes for a little bit. But with Cyril's leadership, especially with this pandemic coming through now, I mean, it's really laid openly and clearly that this government really just doesn't care for its people, the very people, like you said, who put them in place. And so how can we...
Remember when they said, oh, we will have a billionaire president, there'll be no reason for corruption. Laugh.
What a lull. That's literally... Who even... Why would people say... That makes no
Everyone
sense.
Was saying that.
That makes
Everyone
zero sense. First of all, you know, you don't become a billionaire by not being
literally.
Everybody like just magically forgot about like Marikana.
You know, like Cyril did a 9-to-5 every day, and he saved all his money, and then he woke up one day and
self-made.
Self-made hashtag. You know, our very own Kylie Jenner here. So Ramaphosa.
Ugh. But so how do we actually come to a point where we can hold government accountable? I mean, I'm looking at the Minister of Basic Education.
Which one?
I always lull at basic because the education system is literally so basic right now.
And she's so basic, so she's
the
right.
She's so basic. But listen, so I mean, what was the latest stuff now? There was the thing about canceling the food scheme, the feeding scheme in schools. Mm-hmm. And then there was the issue of, you know, if the older educators cannot go to school, then the young ones must just go in their place and basically get COVID and die. And then the other like horrific level of corruption right now, was it like 55,000 iPads? A tender for 55,000 iPads that's going to cost how much? Like 400 million rand that needs to go on loan? Are you kidding me?
They can't even tell you. They can't even tell you what that money is going to cover. They can't even tell you. Because remember, that wasn't the original bill. It increased by about 200.
The original bill was like 1.82 or something like that.
Yeah, and they were like, "Oh, we can't explain the increase." I was like, "You can. It's called looting." That's the increase.
But
you forgot
they
the
are
loot
just
tax.
Running wild. Like
they really are.
How
no, they're unhinged. It's unhinged.
But how do we reel them in? Come on.
I think that, you know, what you're saying about opposition is so important because it's part of the reason why we're so screwed right now. Because if you say the solution to this is that the ANC needs to get out of power, which I agree, who do you put in? I have no faith that John Steenhuisen, everyone's favorite matriculant, or Julius Malema can lead this country anywhere that makes sense, anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have no options. When we had elections last year, and I did a thread on Twitter in which I read the manifestos of every single party on the ballot. It was more than 70 parties.
Jeez.
And
What's the too long didn't read version?
The Twitter thread is the too long didn't read version. The too long didn't read version is that I didn't vote in the election. Because from that 70-odd parties, there's not a single one that you can look at and be like, this is a good alternative, right? They're either like wildly conservatives, so it's like put us in power and we're going to criminalize abortion, and you're just like, whoa, no, we're not doing that. Or they don't have like a proper plan for anything. So in the absence of options, what do you do, right? And that's where we're at right now, is that we have all of these problems. And we know part of the solution is leadership. Part of the solution is changing up the way government works, changing up who's in government, all of those things. But we don't know who to actually put there. So, you know, there's the new thing that's happening now around like independent candidates being able to run for elections. And that might be something very interesting because it gives people a platform to say, if I don't think that there's anyone capable of leading, and if I think I am, I can put my hand up and see if that can be done. But we don't have that kind of political culture either, right? The loyalty that we have to political parties, and it's not just the ANC, it's across the board. That sense of loyalty clouds our judgment because it makes us say that it's okay to put our vote next to a party that we no longer believe in, because we're loyal to that party. We love them. You know, the ANC is the liberation party of this country, right? There's a sentiment and there's a genuine, I think, love that probably all progressive South Africans have very, very deep down in the heart of hearts of saying, you know, but we know what the ANC represents and what it means for this country. Unfortunately, the ANC right now is not the same ANC. And in the absence of options, what do we do? So part of that for me is around delegitimizing these spaces. So during the election last year, like one of the things that my, I guess, agenda was don't vote. Don't do it. Especially as a young person, you have no reason to vote. Because until people say, if we're saying we don't even have political options, what are you voting for? Right? We must be able to say, maybe the system is not working. Maybe it needs to just be collapsed. I might be an anarchist. But I think a lot of it is about seeing what are the spaces that are not working and how do we delegitimize those spaces? So is it, if the political party system is not working, stop voting. Don't show up. You know, that's the only kind of collective action that we can take, is to say, as citizens, we're opting out of this mess. We're not doing it anymore until things start to change. Beyond that, it's so difficult because you can organize as much as you want. You know, if the people at the top are not willing to make any changes, then all of your organizing, all of that collective consciousness doesn't go anywhere. And so I think specifically for young people, it's about firstly trying to get more involved with different organizations, with different causes. You know, if you're passionate about things like education, Equal Education is a fantastic organization doing wonderful work in the sector, and finding ways to support them. And in the absence of that, to be able to just opt out. People often say that youth vote with their feet. And I think that's should be very true for the way we engage as young people is to say, if you're not going to take us seriously, we're walking out, we're leaving. This is not, it just doesn't sustain us anymore.
I want to address the voting thing because, like, you know, I am moving out of the youth space. You know, in South Africa, you're regarded as youth, as a youth until you're like 35 years old.
Yep.
Which is like ridiculous. But I'm slowly moving out of that phase now. But I have never voted. And I'm not ashamed to say that I haven't either. Because like you, I didn't feel that there was any option that I was comfortable with. And yeah. So in that sense, I also voted with my feet. But don't you think that it would serve... And I know you're talking about, like, you know, delegitimizing the entire political system. But do you think that that is a step that wouldn't really work in the scenario that we are in right now? And rather to basically go and vote, but vote blank. Because then those votes still get counted and they can actually see the level of voter apathy and they can actually, you know, not that we rely on them to make the reasonable decisions around our lives, but if we don't go into these voting stations and like at all, we just get discounted. Like we don't exist and they only count the votes that were there and then, you know, those are the votes that get taken into account, and people who are blind, people who are loyal to a fault, to their respective parties, end up making decisions for the rest of us, if that makes sense.
So here's the thing with that, right? Because that was a conversation we had a lot during elections last year. A spoiled vote or a blank vote is counted as only that. So let's say we have 10 million people that are eligible to vote. From the 10 million people, 8 million people do blank votes, right? They'll say to you there were 8 million spoiled ballots or whatever, but it has no bearing on how parliament or the election is decided. So what then ends up happening is those 2 million valid votes, if from those votes, 1 million people voted for the ANC, the ANC wins. So it's
but
not
that's
like,
what would happen if you had to like not vote either, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But in this way, they have a legitimate way to count thing, who doesn't actually care for this voting process.
So that also makes the assumption that they care. Right. And you must know a spoilt vote in this country could be anything. Right. So it could be a political statement where you're writing on your ballot, I don't care about any of this. You guys are terrible. Right. And you send that off. But remember, somebody who makes an X that goes out of the little voting square is a spoilt vote. Someone I was seeing ballots last year. Someone wrote like voted for the EFF and then on the ballot wrote, I love Julius. That's a spoilt vote. So there isn't a differentiation between saying these were spoiled votes because they were political statements and these were spoiled votes because people just did whatever they wanted to on the ballot. And that's where the conversation gets tricky. So for example, in the United States, people get to do a write-in vote, which means if somebody is not on the ballot, you can actually write down their name and that'll count as a vote to them as a candidate. So Beyonce constantly gets hundreds and hundreds of votes every election, right? And in that way, what you're saying about the election is heard because you're having the opportunity to write that down. In our system, a spoiled ballot could be a political statement, or it could be that you accidentally like scribbled on the page, and they don't take it like it's all counted as the same thing. So it's all kind of dismissed as, oh, well, these were just spoiled votes. And they'll write down what they did with the previous election is they wrote it up to voter education. They said people don't know how to vote. And that's why there were so many spoiled ballots. Because it was a big movement last year as well of people saying, spoil your vote, spoil your ballot. And when the conversations came out of the IEC about it, they literally just said, you know, we really need to teach our people how to vote. So we don't live in a system that takes your political opinion seriously, right? And so for me, my argument was the numbers of people that register and then don't, because when you register to vote, you're saying, I'm interested in this process. Nobody goes and registers to vote for fun, right? So you're registering and then you're not showing up. And for me, those numbers say a lot because it's saying people made the effort to register, but then they didn't show up. Why didn't they show up? And that is where you can then begin to have a conversation. We also don't do things like demographically. So they can't tell us how many young people didn't show up to vote. They can't tell us like a race breakdown or anything like that. So we don't have the proper data to say this is who is opting out of the system versus, you know, who's actively voting or whatever. And I think if we had better ways of controlling that data and that analysis, then something like spoiling your ballot works. But in this current system, I don't think that it makes the statement that we think it does.
It's so funny because in literally every other aspect of the society, you need to put down your race, age, and everything else.
And it counts except where
you vote with your vote. Yeah,
because it would be interesting to know, right? It would be interesting to know how are women voting, which parties are, and we don't do things like exit polling or any exit data of any kind. So there's literally no way of knowing how our political society is structured. In the US, you know, after the election of the Orange Man, we knew that the bulk of his voters were white women and white men. We knew, you know, it was very clear that the bulk of there was the majority of black women voted for Hillary. Like, we know this, you know? So, but we don't have that in South Africa. And then the party system further complicates it because then you're voting for the ANC, but no one's ever directly voted to make Cyril the president. Do you know what I mean? So there's so many different, I think, layers that firstly create a very confusing political system, but it also means that the system doesn't need to be simplified or analyzed because they can hide behind, oh, well, it's like super complicated.
I think it's also difficult for people to reconcile the fact that, you know, the liberating party can also be the oppressor party.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, there's a history of it, right? So if you look throughout the continent, the parties who liberated their countries from colonialism and all of that never really lasted very long. The ANC is one of the longest surviving parties that are still in power. And I think that's largely because, you know, we went from colonialism to apartheid, so we had kind of one more level of oppression. But it's a general idea that liberation parties don't last as governing parties. And so it is, first of all, wild that the ANC's lasted this long. But it's scary to think, you know, and I think, you know, we just finished Youth Month and we hear that comparison to the 76 generation all the time. And my friend Tessa often says, you know, they tell us that we must be like the 76 generation and we must organize and we must march and do all those things. But when we do that, they treat us the same way that the apartheid government treated them. So what is the truth? Like, what are we meant to do? And it's so frustrating. You know, when Black Lives Matter started up again this year, in the US, there were so many sad threads from students in South Africa trying to teach Americans how to cope with things like tear gas. And somebody born in 1998 should not have to know. They should not have to ever have seen tear gas in their lives. And yet, that's the reality that we live in. You know, we talk about Marikana like it was just an event. Like, we don't even talk about it. When was the last time you heard about Life as Dimeni? Like, we don't, these things are removed from our memories. They're removed from our discourse. And it's such a heavy, I think, weight to bear, knowing that people who understand oppression probably better than anyone have also then been able to perfect it themselves. And what do you say to that, right? How do you say to your liberator that you're now actually also my oppressor and I think it's time for you to go? And it's not conversations that are easy to have. And I think so much of the burden is placed on young people to have those conversations, but it's just difficult, man.
It is difficult. And I mean, you know, the old folks are always like, they're either also apathetic to the struggles of students, or they're like, well, geez, how the heck are we still marching for these things? Like, this is what we went through when we were young. And it's like, it feels like this sort of cycle of abuse that we are put through as South Africans, you know, and of course, generational trauma becomes a part of that. And how then, with you dealing with generational trauma, can you even think about, you know, added on to that, the fact that you are living in a state of squalor and your government does not really care how you are going to, you know, deal with the fact that your shack or whatever it was is now destroyed in the middle of winter, in the middle of a pandemic.
Whilst you're taking a bath.
Whilst you're taking a bath and you're forced to go to school, a school that they aren't even able to provide, and not on the school's fault, but from the, you know, the government level, to provide support to these schools in the way of personal protective equipment and sanitization and even toilets, like running water. Seriously.
And that's now you must think, right? You're expecting masks from people who couldn't give toilets. Like, you're expecting sanitizing from people that couldn't give toilets. Like, at some point we end up looking like the idiots, right? Like, we end up looking like the silly ones. Because how can we have these expectations from people who have proven to us what their capabilities are? It's ludicrous. But it's also, you know, the thing with schools and COVID is just like mind-blowing to me, because this idea that, so when you were listing all of the big shocks that have happened, right? The other thing was about if schools close because they have COVID and teachers aren't working, the whole minister said, should we still pay them?
Yes.
In a country where people were starving, like people are literally starving.
I freak out because... teachers.
Did we still pay people?
I mean, in the public schooling system, like on the really, you know, lower side of the economic classes, teachers are forking out from their own salaries, you know, in order to try and make the school situation, you know, a place where you can come and feel like you want to learn. You know, they take out of their pockets to laminate posters and make the classrooms colorful. Classrooms that don't even have windows, like seriously, okay? They take out of their pockets to, you know, get these kids on small outings, you know, whatever they can do, or even to feed them, you know, doing even weekend work. And now you have this minister, this basic ass minister, who is saying, like, I'm not sure if they really need to get paid right now. I mean,
something about that is healthy. Is just like, girl, if we're saying if people are not doing their jobs, they shouldn't be paid, how have you been getting paid for the last 20 years? They haven't even taken proper salary cuts. Like, it's not like they've made any kind of measure to accommodate the situation.
And none. Teachers must be none.
Paid. The fact that we've turned teachers into frontline workers is also, like, bizarre, right? Like, the idea of, say, oh, we must save the school year. And you know what? Some of you may die. But hey, we'll save the school year. It's just... sometimes you sit and you think, and then, you know, you hear the president speak and he's like, I'm shocked that gender-based
violence. Oh, please.
I'm shocked at the level of load shedding. And you just sit there and you're just like...
Why are you over there, guy? Why are you, like, the head chairman of the country right now?
Dude, like, at no point did you sit and think, guys, you know, if I didn't know this was all happening right under my nose, like, maybe I'm not the best person for this job.
The CEO of South Africa is shocked at how South Africa is dealing.
Literally. Oh, this happens here. Oh, my goodness. And he finds out about it, like, 4 years later. We've had load shedding started in 2007. Taryn, 2007 was 13 years. Do you know, like, does it, when it hit me that we've been doing this mess for 13 years, I was like, that's almost half my life. I have been living through rolling blackouts. Like, what fresh hell?
It's become and so normalized. Man,
so half my life, I'm living through load shedding. And then this man comes last year and says, I am so shocked that load shedding. So, my dude, since 2007, you've never had a blackout. So, you, stage one, stage four means nothing to you. Like, you're fine.
Bruh, they've got generators in the elevated home.
But they don't even feel shame. Like, I would feel ashamed. One of my biggest fears is looking like I don't know what I'm talking about. Somebody asks me a question and I faff my way through it and it's clear that I don't know what I'm talking about. Like, and these people can sit there and say to you, oh my goodness, you know, I really didn't know GBV was so bad. When global institutions are calling South Africa the rape capital of the world. No, I really, you know, I'm so shocked. Without a hint of irony, without any shame, like the capacity to feel ashamed is non-existent.
It's non-existent. And then they come and say,
we're in it together.
They've been filling their pockets. They don't need to feel any shame. And the thing is, like, a society is only as healthy as the way it treats its poor constituents. And, like, we live in one of the sickest societies. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. Okay, we can go to the beach. Woohoo. But nothing has changed.
We can vote. Yay.
Vote for what? For what?
What? No, it's really, it's also like the generational blackmail of, you know, young people. We're so flippant about this democracy. You know, we underestimate the lives that were lost. Actually, we don't. We're saying because of all those lives that were lost, because of the people that sacrificed their entire lives to make this country free. Despite all of that, it's you leaders that are flippant about our democracy. It's you, right? You've put us in this situation where we can say this vote that was so hard fought for is actually completely meaningless. And what does it mean for a society that has lived through a time where you weren't allowed to vote to now get that opportunity and say, wait, this thing actually doesn't mean anything. Like, y'all could have kept it, actually. Like, we could have just taking the economy, you could have kept voting. Like, it's cool, you know. And it's just, it's so hard to also imagine. How do you imagine our way out of this, right? The fact that you can't even get a driver's license without being corrupt, dude. Like, you can't even drive without being corrupt. Like, it's so entrenched in every single aspect of all our lives. Like, we're all in this corruption together. It's just that we have to be corrupt and do terrible things or dishonest things to just get basic survival, whereas people are living in mansions. Like, I don't know if you saw yesterday this minister on MEC who racked up like a 400,000 rand bill at a hotel because you don't know the story. Okay, your face is telling me you don't know the story. There's an MEC, I don't remember her name or her portfolio, but MEC's most get houses, right? And the state was presenting her with these housing options and she didn't like any of them. So she stayed in a hotel for 7 months and the bill was almost 400,000 rand of taxpayer money because this woman couldn't decide on a house that she wanted.
The fact that something like this is even allowed is just, it's making me want to howl. Like,
because I'm just like, girl, where did you live before? Like, go home, stay in your house. Like, you. What?
It just shows that they don't care.
You know, the COVID response, right? Like, the funniest thing. So, you know, Zinzi Mandela died last week. And, like, collectively, I think as a country, I think all of us felt it, like, on some level, right? I think particularly Zinzi and her mom were the remnants of that fighting spirit that we thought all our leaders had, right? And our relationship, I think, with the Mandelas, so much of it centered around Zinzi and, you know, and that loss was such a huge loss. And I remember thinking, you know, if this was normal, they would probably have some kind of at least a provincial funeral, if not a state funeral. We would all be able to collectively mourn and do all of that. And it's just really, really terrible that we can't do it. And then there was the video footage of all these politicians without their masks, no social distancing, having a party. Apparently the after tears of that funeral was popping. In a time where people are losing entire families and can't grieve. Like, you can, and they did all of that in front of cameras. Like, the news was there and they did it, right? They're so okay with saying, we are more equal than you are, you know? And how do you fix that? Like, really, how do you fix? Because now it's not even just practices. It's not like, oh, you know, government's corrupt, like, they really have bad tender processes. The mentality of thinking I'm better than you, I'm the political elite, and therefore I have more rights than you do, I have more entitlements than you do, what I can do and what you can do. I mean, Black Coffee was in, like, France doing some show for somebody. You know, we haven't been able to see our families all year because of this thing. This man is partying in France. Like, the mentality that access to power and access to money makes you better is ingrained in people's minds. And how do you, like, change that? Personally, I don't know if we should say this, but personally, I'd be very happy if we could see them all. Just
screaming because all of us. The internet literally cut as you just said whatever you said. So I actually didn't hear what you just said.
That's amazing.
That's a sign.
Sabotage comes in many forms.
Is it sabotage or is it like a saving grace?
It's definitely sabotage. I'll say it again. I personally hope that COVID takes them all. I'm not even ashamed. I'm not even upset. I'm not ashamed. What you need to do, Taryn, identify the job you want, fill out your Z83, and then wait. Just wait. Honestly, because at this point, I'm just like, maybe the pandemic is the revolutionary we all need. Maybe Ms. Coco is our new Mandela. She's going to overthrow them for us and just take them out. Let them go and join their comrades.
At this point, it seems like it's the only way out. But we did have the conversation to say, but then what? Because, yes, the ANC is the problem. But so is every other single party within our country. So really, it is the system. And so how do we change the system? How are we able, to get some dignity as a people? Jesus. I mean, it's like, is this so hard to ask for? And so we were talking about, like, how can we, you know, get some form of accountability from our leadership, whatever that means. And basically we can't.
I mean, I think there's still value in collective voice. If for no other reason but to let them know that we're always watching and we remember, right? And our outrage and our tweets and our articles and all of that must also reflect in actions, right? So I agree we don't have political options. And, you know, a few years ago, I remember saying maybe we must just burn down everything, collapse everything, and then just be like, you know what? We really did shit. Let's start again. You know?
I mean, I'm down for that. I'm always down.
Always down for a little bit of, you know, fire.
Arson.
Arson, you know, the side of like tea. Side of vandalism. A pinch of political assassination.
Okay, I'm going to have to edit that out.
I'm dead. It's hard. It's so hard to imagine an alternative because we've also never experienced an alternative, right? So we're having to create something out of nothing. It's not like we can say, oh, you know, we used to do this in South Africa and it really was like a good thing. Like, there's never been a time where we could sit and say, oh, the ship is sailing pretty well. And so it requires a lot of imagination and a lot of work, but the work has to be done. For me, I think, you know, we don't have the greatest civil society. You know, we have a very problematic civil society in this country, but we do have a few organizations, I think, that are doing really, really powerful work. And one of the biggest problems in civil society is resources, right? We don't have money. We don't have funding. We don't have support. We don't have collaboration. And part of, I think, holding government to account is about equipping and capacitating and supporting those parts of society. So I mentioned before, right, if you're talking about education, equal education has been at the forefront of raising issues like infrastructure, nutrition, curriculum for years and years and years. What is it that they need to be able to push their work a little bit more forward, right? And that's what we need to be thinking about, is where are those pockets of society? Because unfortunately, we have to kind of work in baby steps. You know, we have to say, okay, if the country we want to build is one where, you know, kids have infrastructure in schools, who can we support to do that? It has to be about kind of identifying, you know, what are the kinds of tangible issues that need to be addressed? Who are the people working on it right now? How can we support that work? Fall into this trap of like, you know, everything's terrible. There's no end in sight. I was saying today with Andrew Mlangeni dying, that he was, you know, the last Rivonia trialist that was alive. And I was like, now that they're all gone, I feel like we're about to unlock a whole new level of corruption and just don't care attitudes, you know? And
they kept him sort of in check.
Yeah, and unfortunately, or at the very least, symbolically, I don't think it ever mattered. I don't think someone was about to like loot a tender and be like, oh my God, I wonder what Ahmed Kathrada would say. Like, they don't care. But at least symbolically, you know, as a country, we were like, you know, we still have these elders and culturally we know what elders represent. And now they're gone. Like, they've all gone. And it's scary to think about what this kind of generation is going to do. But I think it's so easy to get caught up in, you know, we're never going to be able to remove, or we can't remove the ANC right now. You know, we can't somehow fix opposition parties to be the parties we want. And you fall into that trap of, oh, well, there's nothing we can do, but there is. A lot of it is about small victories. A lot of it is about, you know, community changes, about how do we go to the people that are most affected and better their lives. And for me and my work, you know, that's through community development, that's through kind of civic work. But there are obviously many other ways to do it. And it has to be about identifying the thing that you want to change and finding the people that can support you and that you can support to try and make that change, but also to continue spotlighting what leaders are doing, right? We must never stop talking about Marikana. We must never stop talking about the Zondo Commission. We must never stop talking about Steinhoff and, you know? We have to keep it in our collective memory. We have to keep it in our news cycles, we as tiring and as frustrating as it might be, we must never stop talking about it, because as long as someone is talking about it, someone can work on it, right? And the idea that, you know, corruption, politicians will defeat you by doing nothing, you know, like, and I think COVID is showing us that it's not like they're screwing things up. They're not doing anything. So even when they do nothing, they mess with us and they frustrate us and they push us to a point where we ourselves want to give up and say, we're just not doing this anymore, you know, and you retreat into your homes and your lives and start living that same individual centered life that they live. And that's where they get you, right? Is when our collective mindset is so broken that we can't see a way out. But I think there is. I don't know what that way out is. I don't know how we get there. But I know that it's possible because we have to believe that it is. And it might just be about supporting each other in rioting against the state if we must. But finding ways to amplify each other's work, finding ways to resource each other and to use, you know, our individual influences and power and resources to make a difference in people's lives.
I 100% agree with
hope
that.
Systemic change will follow.
I mean, it's so nice to hear that even though the outset is quite bleak, and I know you are yourself quite, you know, overwhelmed and frustrated with the work that you have been doing. But I mean, there's still a level of faith there. And I love that you do have that, because I think it's easy to get jaded.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're on that forefront, right, of working with people and you see how, you know, government is thwarting your efforts like in every direction. But it's really beautiful when people like you and so many other people who are, you know, forwarding organizations like the Youth Lab and others as well. And it's coming from our voices, you know. Mm. It's coming from our generation, really. And I love that you said, like, amplifying our work and amplifying our voices, because, like, this is literally why I'm also having this podcast, because, like, we're so inundated with media and the representations therein that is often so skewed, and nobody's having these outright conversations about what's really happening, what we can see on the ground. Come on, we're not like, we can see what's going on. And nobody wants to have these very outright conversations about this. And we definitely need to be, you know, collaborating with each other, amplifying each other's work, amplifying each other's voices. And I do believe that this is how we gain back that collectiveness that is so missing from our society.
I think it's also about, like, propping up the people that we do support, right? So I don't think South Africa has no good people that are capable of leading. You know, that's just untrue. There are many people that are fully capable of leading this country into where we need them to be. And identifying those people, working with those people, supporting those people is where it also starts, right? You see young people, particularly, like, we see it in our work, in communities, in youth structures, just fighting the good fight, but not being able to break through that, like, political ceiling. And if it means that, you know what, one day we may start a political party with all of these young people that we have identified as a collective to say, these people represent our hopes and dreams. These people represent our collective interests, and this is who we're going to support. It might start something, you know, but it can only come through collective work. It's never going to come from this kind of individual focused work, you know.
Yeah. And I think, like, that's a really great way that we can bring a close to this conversation, is talking about how the youth, or anyone really, can get involved. with you with equal education, and really, you know, fight that good fight. What can we do?
So what we always say at Youth Lab when people say that they want to get involved is we often ask two questions. Is what are you passionate about and what are you good at? Because everybody has something to offer, right? You have a podcast, so you have a great space to amplify people's voices. And so it doesn't mean you don't have to stretch yourself further than you already are, right? In the space that you occupy, you can do something. And so people need to think about, yeah, what is it that you're passionate about? It doesn't have to be youth. It doesn't have to be, like, we all don't have to fight the same fight. There's enough fights to go around for all of us. But figure that out. Figure out what is that issue when you go to bed at night, you're just like, geez, you know, I wish we could just fix this thing. And then what do you have to offer? Because a lot of the time, you know, we get trapped in putting on kind of expectations. You know, we need money, we need resources, we need this, we need this. And we undervalue what people themselves can offer. So if you can think about, you know, what am I willing to offer? What am I good at doing? What are the resources I have at my disposal, the networks that I have? And how can I use that to better the work that other organizations are doing? I think that's a good starting point. And then, you know, just like tweet us and tell us about it.
All right. Paul Pillay, thank you so much, everybody. That was the managing director of Youth Lab ZA. I'll obviously put all your guys' details in our episode details, but why don't you just tell us how people can get in touch with you in any case?
Sure. So if you're trying to get a hold of Youth Lab, you can find us on social media at Youth Lab ZA. Or if you want to pop us an email, you can just do it at info@youthlab.org.za. And then if people want to get in contact with me, the best way is kind of find me on Twitter at Pearl Pillay.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed this conversation. It's obviously, like I said, bleak, but, you know, we got to talk about it. But
thank you for having me. I wish I had happier content for you. But it's important for us to kind of confront our realities, however bleak they may be. And I hope that this can spur broader conversations about what being, you know, a contributing citizen looks like. And hopefully there's space to do lots of cool work afterwards.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I will catch you on the book and we'll chat soon. Thank you so much for coming through. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Remember, folks, do follow us, like us, whatever you got to do on wherever you're listening to this podcast from. Rate, review, you know, just tell us what's happening. Find us on the gram at What's the Quarantine. On Facebook, we have the Facebook group of the same name as well as the page. So do follow us, find us, you know, talk to us, let us know what's on your mind. And if you really, really enjoy the podcast, please, most importantly, tell a friend. We love people to get more involved, you know, learn something new, or, you know, critique us. I don't purport to have all the information, but merely to be a voice for at least some information that we aren't getting in mainstream media. So please support us by telling a friend and giving us that like and share. Thanks, guys. I'll catch you next week.